They don't slow down sea cans. What's the worst fire you've been in?
I would say the fire, the Crane Swamp fire he's talking about. I was a line supervisor on that fire, and I seen that fire taught me more than any fire I've ever been on. We actually had what we call fire storms on that fire, where the weather was being affected locally by the fire. It was so much heat being generated. It's like a thunderstorm. It was actually lightning in the smoke plume of that fire. Wow. It was raining. The fire, it made its own rain. This fire we had over in Baker County just a few weeks ago created its own weather, where it made it started making rain itself at about 30,000 feet. But that fire in Volusia County in 81 made its own lightning and winds and just local, affected the local weather altogether.
Do we have any other questions anybody would like to ask?
Okay, I can only speak for state. There's been numerous volunteer structure firefighters fighting woods fires that have died, but in our history, three. Yeah, good record.
We run. we get in trouble.
We have a lot of timber industry people that assist us on fires. They want to actually own a lot of the property and own the timber on the property, so they're of course involved with firefighting, especially on their property. And the most recent was we had an industry employee killed on a fire we were on, right here just north of Lake City, up on the Georgia-Florida line.
Do you have sort of a network you use for, what I'm wondering is some of the rangers really don't live on the area, so... How do you, is it a matter of telephone calls or you're on call? Is it radio work? Do all of you have a radio that you keep in touch by? So if there's a fire and you need to get a bunch of people on, how do you get a hold of them?
Okay. Like Mr. Roberts was saying, all of our equipment is set up with radios. And we have a communication system where during normal working hours, they can be reached by that radio.
Mm-hmm.
After hours... we have a system set up where we have rangers on call at night, and usually it's by telephone with them, possibly a portable radio. I didn't bring mine with me. We have portable radios we carry with us, and we also have pagers where our dispatch centers can beep us and give us the message to call them or respond to the fire or put our equipment in service or whatever. So we're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to set any fires just to see you. Have any other questions that people might like to ask? Yes, sir.
Something you haven't mentioned that I'm well aware of is the close cooperation, at least, I'm from Volusia County, between county organizations and local fire departments and the Forest Service.
Okay.
And how they probably will all be interacting on a major fire.
Exactly. Back in after the Crane Swamp fire, in 1982 and 83, we enacted the incident command system, where it's a system set up where we coordinate all our activities on a wildfire, woods wildfire, with all the county agencies such as volunteer firemen, most of the paid fire departments, with the sheriff department, local sheriff departments, all kind of emergency operations people. And this system really works well for us, and the last 3 or 4 years we've really put it to use a lot, and it's something that's really, really going good. The volunteer fire departments help us out tremendously. Usually they're established in areas of rural areas where there's not a city fire department, and they respond to a lot of fires for us, and usually put them out before we can ever know about them. So they do a real good job for us, and we're very proud of it.
Yes, and also this year we got the frequency for the volunteer and the fire department. We got those on our radio now, so we can talk directly to them instead of going through the office to come back to them.
That's great.
Is that statewide then?
Yes, it's a red, white, and blue channel. It's a statewide radio frequencies that the Florida Firemen's Association was asked to incorporate within the fire department radios. We have them on our radios. We have an 80-channel radio. We can put as many frequencies in it as we, you know, we'd like, really, you know, up to 80. And that's a lot of radio frequencies. Mm-hmm. So we currently now can, you know, within our own in our own district, I know, we can talk to every fire service within our district, six-county area.
And that's what, within the last year that that's got in operation?
2 years that I can remember. This is part of the ICS system, incident command system I was talking about. It's, that was a requirement, or a that's a system originated in California, where they were second behind California by number of fires. California is number one in the nation on number of fires. We're second, the state of Florida. So we've seen a need for it. It's working well for them, so we incorporate it within our own services.
I knew I was hearing that on the air, but I didn't know that was statewide.
That's right.
Okay, well, thank you very much for taking this time with us, and we'll see you hopefully
I encourage everybody to come by and look at the booth if they'd like and ask any more questions.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Okay, take care. Whoops, be careful. Okay, we're going to break just for a quick second, and then we're going to, we've got the fires fought, the fires out, and we got lots of live trees, and we're going to talk about using natural resource of the trees, turpentine, so we'll be right back. You going to do the cruising now? Anybody who wants to go out and do some cruising can go out and do some cruising now to figure out how thick and how thick the trees are and what you need, what can be used. And you can just meet right over there. We were going to do it at 1:45 so we could do this workshop. So why don't you go have another Coke and come on back. Yeah, I thought you'd like that. Okay, we got the fires fought, we got the trees saved, and we still got a way to use them. And I'd like you to meet E.W. Carswell and Kent Ramsey. What we're going to do here is just going to sit and talk about one of the natural resources that comes out of trees without having to actually kill the tree. And that's turpentining. Turpentining used to be a very prosperous industry in this state, but I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Carswell now, who can tell us more about how it was prosperous and why.
Well, I think to do that, I will have to go back to colonial days when we were, our country was, were English colonies primarily, and in Carolina they found a source for turpentine, tar, and products of the pine tree, and that was, of course, an English colony. And that was the time, too, that the British were developing their fleet. They were developing a worldwide commerce in the British Navy, which sort of dominated the seas for many years, practically into World War I. But the basis for that, there were sailing ships past the Civil War. They would use the tar and the turpentine rosin to own their sailing ships. And they did that right on. That gave rise to the term naval stores. The British called it naval stores because they got this material to use on their ships. It gave rise to the name Jack Tar for a British sailor, and Tar Heels for North Carolinians, including some of their ball teams to this day. And so we got several names for it in that era. But in the process, they used up their trees pretty much and had to move the industry southward. My hometown now is Chipley, and we had several of those North Carolina producers to come to Washington and neighboring counties over there to produce turpentine. In 1900, from 1900 to 1910, in fact, Chipley claimed to be the biggest turpentine rosin shipping center in the world, an inland center. Of course, the produce went to such ports as Pensacola, Jacksonville, and Savannah for shipment abroad. And but we had the finest pines, after all, and the most productive ones in South Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. And so that's where the industry ended up, and until about World War I, when circumstances sort of caused the industry to sort of fade out. And we have a few producers still in some parts of the state, I understand. We have only one in West Florida, and we have him here with us. And he knows all about it more than anybody that I know of, the hands-on part of it. So we'll let him tell you what, if you may, whatever we wish.
Thank you, Mr. Carswell. I basically got started in turpentine and followed my father around. About all I know there. He'd done it all his life. I carried him water there to start with, and he was pulling trees. He built me a little ladder to go up there and spray the acid on the trees to help it run. Of course, when I got on up 13 or 14, really big enough to help him out, I was wanting to do something else for a while. But gradually, I got out. I went to work with Royal Crown Kohler, and I still kept my hands in it, working with some people up there that had some trees. Well, they got out of it, and I kind of got to missing it. So I checked around, went to the county forester, and turned out there were several people that were interested in having their trees turpentine. So I got up with them. We worked out an agreement, and basically I've been turpentining ever since.
What
are the past 10 years.
What are the steps that you have to take? What we're going to do is explain the steps here and then go on over to the turpentining area so Kent can show you exactly what it is that he does, and you can ask him questions there too. Can you sort of start from step one to step to the last step that you know of, of what you do?
First of all, there's only two types of pines you can use, which is a slash pine or a longleaf pine or a yellow pine. And you rost the tree down with a scrape iron. You smooth the bark off so you can attach two aluminum gutters with double-headed nails. This will make for easy extraction. Make what they call a jump streak in a tree to start with. It's a small, narrow streak. This gets the tree acclimated. It is filling an injury down there, so it'll start rushing the turpentine down there, much like you see a bug go into a tree. It'll make the pitch to put him out there. After about two streaks, it's really starting to push the gum down there. So after the sap goes to rising, March and April, on to about October, you make that cut about every 3 weeks, treat it with your acid paste, harvest it about once a month or every 6 weeks, depending on the weather. Put it into a 55-gallon barrel and take it over there and sell it at the distillery. And they distill the mineral spirits and the rosin out, and they sell it to various people that have a need for it.
Now, there's a name, actually, for that streak. You call it streaking or cat face?
Well, the term cat face come because of it looked like a cat's whiskers. Mm-hmm. Some people apparently thought. I've heard it called a herringbone streak. I never heard it called that. Smiling face. I never heard it called
smiling
that.
Smiling face, that's great.
Basically, I use a straight across streak when they're lower the first 2 or 3 years. When they get on higher, it's easier to make that cat face streak from the standpoint of where you're pulling your hack from.
How long can you use one tree?
If it's a big enough tree, 10 inches or above, you can for 5 years on one side, 5 years on the other. Mm-hmm. But you have to leave 4 to 5 inches bark space between the trees to carry the nutrients from the roots to the leaves.
Okay, so basically you're really not killing the tree.
No.
It's just a real matter of wounding it.
The old method of doing it now was it was detrimental to the tree, where they'd actually every week make a cut into the tree,
mm-hmm.
a very deep cut.
Yeah.
So you'd see a lot of scarred up trees these days.
And that's
as a
why.
Result of that.
That's why. And does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask here so they know a little more about the steps that you need to take for turpentining? Anybody? Yeah.
The type I use is 25% sulfuric, 25% ethyl, which is a chemical, and 50% is ground up pecan shells. It's a feller up in Helena, Georgia makes it, Mr. Charlie Grimsley. He produces all the turpentine tools, and he's it right now. If something was to happen to him, I don't know what we'd do. Mr. Carswell could probably help you out with that more than I could.
There's several things that the production of chemicals substitutes for one thing. The paper companies also extract turpentine from their pulpwood before they make pulp out of it. And so they furnish a lot of the chemicals that turpentine did use. We used to use it as a paint thinner, and there's another chemical now that it takes that over. So a lot of chemicals primarily, I think, is one reason. They're produced cheaper than we can produce the turpentine, maybe, with the competition that comes from the paper companies and so on.
Now, when they were turpentining in the years past, they were pretty, there were large crews of people, weren't there, doing that kind of work, Mr. Carswell?
Oh, yes. They were quite a number of men working in the woods at all times. Some of them specialized work, some of them were chippers, and some of them dippers. And preparing it, and then you had people, distiller, and other people working at the stills. and Cooper that makes the barrels. It was quite an industry.
And in fact, let's just share a little bit of information, in fact, on those barrels. Did Mr. Dupree make any of those kinds of barrels, too? You know?
Did Mr.
Dupree?
Yes, Mr. Dupree, who died a few weeks ago, did make those kinds of barrels. He had a reputation. Some people said he was the best barrel... the best barrel maker in the country, and one day he made as many as 100 rosin barrels. They were made out of staves, and they had some equipment that you put the barrel together and put some hoops around it, and we'd use it to put the rosin in. After it got in there, it would get hard quickly. As it cooled, it would get hard, and we had a lot of rosin. It burned easily, too. I saw a boatload of it one time catch fire and made quite a fire.
Gosh, we could have called the Department of Forestry and had them come in. You know, maybe we should start. No, let's not and say we did. Okay, for those of you who are interested, let's go on out to the turpentining area and back here, and let's just see how the whole thing works, because there's a little bit of nailing. You got to attach some things, and it's easier to show you how to do it than it is to see it. So let's go on out.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who's the bellator? Who's the leader?
If you've been with us earlier today, you know that we've been talking about the process of growing timber and then the process of harvesting it and getting it out of the woods and the kinds of things that get done with it. The next step in the process, of course, is taking that tree and turning it into something that you can use, one of those somethings being boards. So the next half hour or so, we have a bunch of experts here to tell you about different aspects of the milling process. We have one new person today, but I'll start going down here on the left. These are people who've worked at different times and in a real variety of different situations. There's a lot of variety in what happens, so they'll get a chance to tell you about what they do and also do a little bit of comparison between new styles and old and big mills and small ones. So starting on my left here, we have Mr. Sam Baker. He has done a variety of jobs, worked a few years ago. Next is Barbara Dye, who's the plant manager for the Corbett Cypress plant that's about 9 miles north of here. A fairly small operation, and she's the one who keeps it in order. Next to her is Emmanuel Solomon, similarly has worked in the woods in a variety of capacities, but has worked in the mills. Next to him is Steve Lindemann, who works with Georgia Pacific now. He buys wood for a much bigger mill and one that makes plywood, so he'll tell you a little bit about that. And then down at the end is Mr. Neil Varnes, who, if you've been around, you may have seen him operating his small mill right over across the way there, a one-man operation. Well, let's start... We'll start with Barbara. I keep doing this to her, but she's a good sort of middle person to talk about it. Can you explain to the folks here the process when the wood comes into your yard? What are all the different things that happen before it comes out the other end?
First of all, when we take it off a truck, we sort it out. The biggest lumber, biggest log, we take it to the stack. Make lumber out of it. And the very small logs, we saw it up and we put it in a hog and grind it up. And mostly all, we just take the small lumber and we grind it up, make mulch out of it, and the bigger lumber, we make lumber out of it and shingles.
Okay. One of the things that I realized in talking to folks across North Florida is that it's very important to make the decision about how to get the biggest amount of lumber out of a given piece of wood, out of a given tree. And Mr. Solomon was involved. Tell him about the job that you used to do, setting blocks, and that whole process of working with the man who made those sawing decisions.
I was the block setting the logs. Well, the log was... come into the mill, he puts it on the log ramp, have the ramp there, and you roll, so have the man there to roll the log down, and from the ramp, he places on the carriage. After it's placed on the carriage, have one man on one end, and he dogged that end, and I was the block set, I would dog the other end also. The sawyer would be standing outside, and he'd give me a sign how far you want me to bring the log out where the saw you saw would take off just a slab off the side where you can look at the log and see what size board or what size of material you want to make out of it. So he'll give me the sign. I'll take my leave and shave out just a little bit at the time till it come out where you want it. He stopped me, then you go sawing. He'll take the slab off. I'll go back down with the carriage. He gave me another sign. Say, for instance, he wanted 1 inch bowl. He gave me a sign 1 inch, and he wanted one. I set it on 1 1/4. I always set it another quarter going to allow enough for the saw to take out somebody when they're sawing it out. He say 2 inch. Say, for instance, he wanted 10. He gave me one finger and point to his nose. This hole represent a zero in your nose. Okay, he wanted 12. Two fingers in your ear. You represent two. So, and he wanted, some people, sometimes you want a seven. That's a seven. This is an eight. This is a nine. And some people give 10 this way, too. So he used to give me the sign, one finger with his other hole here for a zero. Yes. So after that, the slab, after cut the log, squared up to what he wanted. Maybe he want to make an 8-inch board. Then he, if it's squared up to 8 inches, maybe 10 inches, whatever you want to square it up to, then you saw it all the way up 1-inch boards. It'd be a 1 by 10, a 1 by 8, a 1 by 6, or whatever it would be. He also give a 6 this way. That's a 6 sign in sawmilling. So the slab, after you take the slab, it goes off out there. And he, nowadays, they save the slab. They grind it up and I think they call it chips. They use it for fuel wood. But years when I first started sawmilling, they had something they call a slab kicker. That slab will go out there on the roller bed and it'll be a man out a little farther down. He'll take it off the roller bed and throw it on a thing built, a drum. Have prongs on it, probably inch and a half long. It'd be twin. Have a smaller pulley on the one end, have a belt run to it, and the belt runs back to another small electric motor or some kind of motor we have back. It'll be turning. And it'll kick it. It'll kick the slab. When you throw the slab on this drum with kicking, it'll kick the slab way on out there. Which is a pretty dangerous thing, because I have seen people get hurt. You throw it into the drum, it'll kick it back on you.
You got to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm.
I had a question that they had to fill me in when I first found out about this, which is why this elaborate system of hand signals? Why can't he just tell you how big he wants it to be?
Well, it's a noise. It's abandoned. Now, where I was working at, there's some mills, electric mills nowadays, but where I was working at it was a diesel mill.
Big diesel, it makes a lot of noise.
It makes a lot of noise. So instead of him talking, he gives the hand signal. Mm-hmm. You couldn't hear him if you was talking to you again. But nowadays, most of all that by computer. You done took that man off in the carriage and dog it. He sit there with the instruments and dog it all, do it all by itself. It cut the wick out of probably 6 mills now.
Steve, can you tell us some more about what goes on in a modern mill, and particularly this plywood operation is pretty fascinating.
Okay. As she touched on, I buy logs for a pine ply mill, Georgia Pacific's mill in Hawthorne, Florida. Not too far from here, it's just the other side of Gainesville. As she alluded to, it's a modern mill. Most of the processes in there are now computerized. And basically what happens is the logs come in, again, either on trucks or on rail cars, and they're unloaded. And then they go into the mill, and the logs are cut into 8-foot, 9-inch blocks because they're going to be put on a lathe. And our mill there has two lathes running side by side. The logs, before they get to the lathe, have to be soaked in a hot water solution to soften them to allow the lathe to cut them without it cracking the wood. They go through a debarker. It takes the bark off the logs. It goes through the soak, which softens the fiber so it can go into the lathe. And then when it hits the lathe, this is where the computer basically takes over it. The lathe comes in and it chucks on both ends. It spins the log quickly and a laser eye scans the log and determines the high and low points on the log and sets the log to optimize every bit of wood coming off that to eliminate as much waste as possible. Once the computer sets the log, it starts turning the log, and it turns the log and puts it against the knife. And once it hits the knife, it starts coming off as one continuous sheet. And the only way I can describe that process is like taking a roll of toilet paper or paper tissue and just grabbing it and having it free spinning and just pulling it off. It just comes out, and it's several logs per minute go through each of these lathes. So the whole process, the log goes in, chunk, it's spun once, and then it spins off. And like I say, they can do four or five of these a minute. And there's two lathes running side by side. So it's just a continuous process. These logs are just going through. The reason it's cut in those lengths, the 8'9", is to allow for trim. And this stage is set up on 8-foot panels of plywood. Once the sheet comes off the log and it becomes veneer, then it goes through a cutter. That's also computerized. The piece is scanned as it goes through, and it's chopped into the pieces. The pieces are fed into a steam dryer. Glue is sprayed on, and if you look at a piece of plywood, what gives it its strength is the fact that the plies are laid down. First, the plies are going with the grain one way, and then the grain goes the next way on the next piece. And they alternate the grains, and they vary the thickness simply by putting more pieces of veneer together. If you want 1-inch plywood, you use so many pieces. They know, plus the glue, it'll end up being that much. Once the panel is laid up, it goes into a steam dryer, which just a large rack, and all these pieces go in it, and it presses together, and it has a steam jacket that runs steam through the whole thing and dries the panels. And then the dried panels come out, and they're trimmed up, and that's it. They're finished plywood.
It's a pretty
question. Do you do anything besides rotary cut? That's what you call a rotary cut, is it? Rotary cut veneer?
Not at that mill, we don't.
You're familiar with the other type of veneer?
Mm-hmm.
I know about it, but I don't know how they cut it, but I know about the other type of veneer, and I thought maybe you might know about it and be able to touch on it, but if you don't do it right.
Well, probably what you're talking about is a system where
you slice it off,
and they use that mostly in hardwood veneers.
Right.
And they do that so that they can match the grain exactly.
A lot of your furniture cuts.
Right. That's more important when you're trying to match the grain and end up with one sheet that has exactly the same grain. If you look at the plywood under our feet, it's got patches in it. It's got different grain running across it. You know, some of these pieces didn't come from a continuous sheet. You see that piece right there? They went halfway across it and stopped it. As the veneer first comes off, it's patchy and it's not continuous, so they chop that up into small pieces, and they don't waste any of that. They fit it in together and use it to make sheets out of it.
It's a pretty amazing process. Now, Mr. Barnes is at the other end of this spectrum. In a plywood mill, there are hundreds and hundreds of people working, but he's a one-man operation. Tell us all about what you do.
I'm at the other extreme. I'm chief cook and bottle washer. I work right by myself. I do my own logging, and I do my own sawing. I do my own marketing. Primarily what I do is market my own timber. My little portable mill has given me an excellent outlet for my lumber. And I don't even have to compete with this fella here. He's got to compete with me. It's a very economical way for a timber owner, a small woodlot owner, to market his timber for top dollar, really. It's very simple and very safe. Plenty of hard work.
Are you cutting special orders? Are you taking orders from people for certain size lumber?
Not from people, from a people. From one man gets mine.
Oh, you got one fellow out there making orders for you.
Whenever I cut a tree down, I know what it's going into already. And the whole tree goes to the same man. I don't have to look around for somebody to take the inferior cuts. He gets the whole thing. Works out beautiful for me. Of course, that's the beauty of a small operation, you know, and it's quite different from what these other people are familiar with.
There's one man we haven't heard from yet. Mr. Baker, tell them about your job in a mill.
Well, I've done a lot of it at the mill. I work up in the mill, and I worked when you're stacking lumber. We come out on a roller bed and come on to a vat, and he comes right on out on two or three capers, and we have to put it and stack it just right. Sometimes we put it on sticks, and sometimes we just put it out booked up. We get out to the yard and somebody else stack it. And we just put every length to itself, every size, and every all of it, right to itself, you know, one to the other, right down that line. So each man come out there, the boss man come out there, he can see it all level and everything done just like it's supposed to be. If you don't, he make us tear it down and go over it again.
This is a perfectionist here, I figured out.
And that's the way it's done. So and I have done that a many time. So and I got expense on that, so we got moved up. Well, I have found we have done some more itemized about some cypress. We had cut some cypress, and we did hit cypress. Like this lady, you went to her mill, cut some deadhead cypress. They've been in the ground there, I reckon, 40 or 50 years, laying there in the ground, some cypress trees. Well, they cut back when they was cutting them in two with a broadaxe, cut them in two and they left them there, they couldn't get them. And in the mud, so they have a machine now to get them out of that mud and drag them to the hill, and they load them on a truck and they carry them to the sawmill. And a whole lot of time they let them lay out there maybe 6 months, maybe a year. And again, they don't. They take them right on and they let them go through the sawmill. And they cut all kind of deals out of them.